Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we'll be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales for November 2018 is sold through Diamond to retailers predominantly in North America. Now, we do have the top 500, but when we do historical stuff, we tend to limit it to the top 300 just so we have an apples-to-apples comparison going further back. And now, we only go so far back on the trade side versus the comics, which had always been for the top 300 since the start of the Final Order era back in early 2003 when Diamond first started reporting what they were actually invoicing to retailers for the month. Prior to that, they were doing it based on pre-orders, which on the comic side was kind of messed up because there were a lot of things that just never came out. We've got a two-month overlap. But anyways, back then on the trade side, it was like the top 10, the top 25, then the top 50, then the top 100, now then the top 300. Now, we've been routinely getting the top 500 for a bit. And I don't know about you, TJ, but for me, I think that plays into where some of the sales numbers are at. Think about it. We've got the top 500 trades every month as a ranking, meaning there's more below that. Now, granted, there's reorder activity, etc. There's a hell of a lot of choice for people when it comes to buying trades.
Absolutely. And unlike the single issue market where, you know, 3 weeks after the issue is out, a lot of that stuff, if there's no speculator demand or cover chasing, that stuff almost goes to the dollar bin or worse. So,
yeah, I think it's funny because I think on the trade side, there's some stuff that, man, if it doesn't sell immediately, it probably never will. And there's other stuff that, man, it'll sell forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and there's, I'm curious how much fits into that middle ground of neither extreme. And I really just don't know.
Well, and I think it's really difficult to know because there's so much product coming out. And especially, you know, when you add up, you know, when you add in the manga and you add in everything else, there's just so much middle ground and middle class. And you know, a lot of these things are just because that's where the economics are. They're designed to be series. And the longer they can go get the series to run, the more money they can, because you basically get this economic stacking of, if you can get to seven or eight trades, it's almost a self-sustaining, in on some level, self-sustaining, is that there's enough money to continue the story until you actually feel it, you can complete the story. I think one of the things you see at Image a lot is that the single issues can't get the story far enough in to get enough trades to really financially support the finishing of the story. A lot of these creators, I think, have 30 issue runs, because I think, you know, at Vertigo, it used to be 60 issues, you know, 5 to 6 years used to be considered what you would always shoot for. Now I think a 30 issue run is the highest you can realistically get. And even that, I think a lot of the newer series are having a hard time getting sustainable sales to get there.
In this day and age, does it make sense for a creator to go out with that kind of a game plan? I don't think so.
Not a new creator, right? So people like Jeff Lemire, people like a few of the other guys at Image, which basically have other books that are successful cross subsidizing their new efforts to get off the ground. Think about Robert Kirkman. He could try 25 new series with all the money he's making off Walking Dead and hope that another one hits, right? He has that much money to bankroll.
True, but if he were to do that and the first two dozen of them have a 30 or 60 issue plan and he gets a year in and stops,
yeah,
you know, by the time he hits that 25th, it could be capturing that lightning in a bottle again. Is it going to have a bit more of an uphill battle because people will say, well, you know, it's only going to go for a year. I'll wait till the second year, see if it continues.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting the way you phrase that, because you could say that that's the thinking that way is, or I should say thinking the opposite direction is what Mark Millar, right, does. He does 5 to 6 issue series, hopes to get them optioned in some form at Hollywood or TV, and then moves on to the next property with another high-end creator, right? So it's kind of like different approaches, different way they view the art, when I say art, I mean the comic book medium as like a business tool for art, you know what I mean? So it is interesting.
Well, and it's funny because I think we could argue either way as to if either Kirkman or Millar is more successful than the other, because I think they're both very successful but in slightly different ways. Because Mark Millar, with that, do a handful of things enough to fill a trade and then move on. He's had numerous movies, TV show or, you know, type stuff options or whatever. and got bought out by Netflix. So I don't think anyone could consider him unsuccessful. I think he's made quite a bit of money and done very well for himself and has a good library of material.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, you know, with Kirkman, he's had fewer properties, although he's had a fair number of properties. But most of them have been of the longer running sort versus the do a miniseries, move on.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't had, you know, the buyout kind of a thing along the same ways as Mark Millar, but, you know, he's now a major partner over at Image, so he's clearly done well for himself. And, of course, 10-year run for The Walking Dead on AMC, he's not hurting there either.
Yeah.
And the radically different approaches to do something and stick with it forever or, you know, I don't say the shotgun approach of Mark Millar, but it kind of is. You know, keep blasting stuff out there, and the rapid fire has some advantages, and the slow, methodical build up a huge following has an approach too.
Mm-hmm.
It's in this day and age, I would say, if you're starting out, the Mark Millar approach of essentially fill a trade, move on to the next property, probably the smarter move.
Yeah, well, and it is interesting. It is interesting in that sense is that. Would someone like Jonathan Hickman, who initially built his chops outside of the superhero genre, because I know a lot of people came to him at Marvel and things like that, but on those small little, you know, what, 4 to 6 issue series that he did, you know, Pax Romana, mm-hmm. and those versions of that. But that was the beginning of his career. And now he loves to tell long stories like East of West and, you know, things like that, where they're just long and complicated. Even his Avengers stuff over at Marvel was pretty intricate in terms of how it crossed over the different books and was I think he initially had like 100-issue story he wanted to tell, which obviously got, you know, cut down by Marvel's business realities. But it's interesting how he started his career off doing those short things to kind of at least give, you know, help find an audience of people who like-minded people who liked the way he told stories. And then, you know, as he expanded his stuff, he kind of became more of a long form guy. And it's interesting to see would his storytelling's like techniques that he does now as long form be, if he was a no-name guy trying to break in, would that be successful today? Or would you really do need to stick with the shorter kind of build small successes that build up into an overall audience, which then you can take with you, you know, versus just hoping, like, you know, hoping for a big hit like the Kirkman, you know, like, which most people will strike out.
I think the challenge, if you're going to go for the long form, is having enough payoff early on
mm-hmm.
in the short form that mm-hmm. people stick around for the long form.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that, because I read Jonathan Hickman comics and I actually like them quite well. But I feel like they oftentimes don't have short to intermediate payoff. It's when you read the entire thing in one gigantic chunk. And I'm talking like 500 to 1,000 pages where you really get the sense of, wow, this is quite an accomplishment. Now, maybe that's just my interpretation of his style or how I come at his work. But I wonder if because the other thing is I've listened to podcast interviews by him, and he's very particular about, he's like, you either like my stuff or you don't. I'm not going to change the way I do my stuff. If you don't like it, don't buy it. You know what I mean? But he's also it's hard to judge that, because he's also been successful. You know what I mean? So if he hadn't been successful, maybe he would have had a little bit more pressure to change the way he does things. But he has a very unique style. And I've also heard people say, I don't like the way he writes, or it's not entertainment. It's more of like him preaching at you about certain things about society and things like that. So it is interesting sometimes how creators can almost pigeonhole themselves or get stuck that way.
Well, I think each creator's got to remain true to themselves and play to their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's also a matter of, by doing that, you got to be aware that the market may not accept your work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just the comic industry is a fairly brutal marketplace and kind of unforgiving at times. And as the prices go up, as the attention wanes, and there are other ways to fill the void, if you want, be it superhero stories or other what would have been traditionally comic book based stories, we can now find them on TV, movie, Netflix, etc. very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've got to keep the reader engaged and coming back. And I think some writers do that better than others. And each writer has a particular audience they will do it very well for. It's a question of how big and how well they can find that audience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's I think we're past the age where starting out by saying, I'm going to do this story and it's going to take 30, 40, 50 issues to really tell the full thing. We're past the age where the odds of you getting those 30, 40, 50 issues or whatever is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you look back at the creators that have had historically long runs, the 100 issues or whatever, they're rarely telling the same story at the end that they started out telling.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they've been on the title forever, but they've told a lot of stories. Things have changed. The characters have evolved, and it's not one massive arc beginning to end. I think that's totally true for, like, The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the characters that title started with aren't around.
Mm-hmm.
So we're clearly not following their story, and the status quo has changed significantly over, and that's good, but it just seems that some creators get a little indulgent in their storytelling, and I think that's very much factoring in on some of the sales trends we see.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you there. I just almost wonder, though, if the market, the way that the two major companies, DC and Marvel, specifically Marvel mostly, have created a sense in the customer that there's so much material coming out, they've almost trained them to not, they've trained away their attention span. Because you used to have people that would stay on books, even if they didn't necessarily like something, for, you know, they would just wait till a new creative team came on or whatnot. And I just think the tolerance for that is so much lower now, and people just are willing to get on and off books easily. And the thing that enabled books to get to 60 issue run was consistent sales, and you just don't have that anymore without gimmicks, you know?
Well, I think they've totally trained readers to not stay on a title till it gets better, because it'll get better when the creative team changes. And over at Marvel, when the creative team changes, they renumber the volume.
Mm-hmm.
So you just pick up the new number one. You get off the title you had been on.
Mm-hmm.
And given how few titles at Marvel are going past 20 issues, 30 issues, the idea of telling a long story over at Marvel just seems a little ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go through at least two major, you know, universe-shaking events in that time, and are your characters going to come out intact enough to continue the story is the question. I just, the kinds of stories creators seem to want to tell seem to be gravitating towards the long form, yet the sales are indicating the short form is the kind of story that needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think there's a definite disconnect there, and I think that's why we wind up with sales where, even if in aggregate they're doing okay, in particular there's downward trends and you know, non-stellar performance on many titles.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of sales, let's take a look at the breakdown of the top 300 for the trades this time. Unsurprisingly, Marvel had the largest percentage of the top 300. It was 30.79% of the units and 35.44% of the dollars. So, you know, roughly a third there. DC had the second largest share. They had 21.9% of the units, 26.33% of the dollars. Both cases there, higher percentage for dollars than units. Again, this goes back to a higher average cover price, which, let's face it, in the trades category, there can be a huge discrepancy between the lowest price item and the highest price item on the list every month. Matter of fact, I think it's about a 20-to-1 ratio for Marvel, about a 10-to-1 ratio for DC.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the lowest price item for Marvel was $9.99, and their highest was $200. That's pretty hefty. DC's lowest was $12.99. Their highest was $125, which is still hefty, but not as hefty as $200. And then Image, not too far behind DC by units, had 18.53% of the units, but only 13.4% of the dollars. And that goes to a much, much lower average cover price. Image's lowest cost item was $9.99. Their highest cost item was $49.99. And their average was a little over $17, whereas it was around $31 for Marvel and DC, a little above, a little below. Above for Marvel, below for DC.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, obviously, using the dollar units as an indication of is a company making more or less money? Either way, either units or dollar percentages from month to month is a horrible comparison metric, because it depends on the size of the pie every month. But certainly the percentage for the dollars can be really skewed based on just the cover price and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's nothing new. If we look at it by units, Marvel had 73,235 units, DC had 52,096 units, and Image had 44,071 units. And then from there, it kind of drops off significantly. Viz having 11,735 units. Dark Horse 10,909 units, and everything below that is obviously under 10,000. And we had a number of publishers on the list, but really some of them had such negligible sales because they only would have like an item or so on the list that you add up everybody kind of below Dark Horse, which rounded out the top five publishers. And we're talking, let's see, 45,823 units. So all said and done, roughly the equivalent of a little over what Image did this month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's spread across 27 different publishers. But the nice thing about the trades list is we get a lot more publishers on the list, but it really is potluck as to what did they have come out that month or what was reorder activity for them that month as to how well they did.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on the breakdown look particularly interesting or worth talking about?
I did notice that Viz is doing better than, well, at least for this month, was higher than Dark Horse, Boom, and IDW. And I don't remember that being the case the last couple of months. Is that just like it's near the end of the year, and I think a lot of companies are publishing a lot of stuff to get ready for the holiday?
I think it's a little of that, and I think also that Viz has been doing a little better than it had been of late. I know at one point back when Chris and I were doing the trades numbers, Viz was doing great with a lot of the manga because it was just in a better shape back then.
Yeah, before Borders went out of business and all that, yeah.
Yeah, but even that wouldn't have really impacted these numbers, but I think it impacted the awareness and accessibility of manga. And I question if over that 10-year period or whatever, if anime has gotten enough accessible to people that's kind of taken over the interest, or if where that audience went is really the question.
No, and I completely agree with you, and especially now with the streaming option, because a lot of the series that were very popular that you could only watch on TV, if you recorded it, now a lot of those are being brought to the various streaming services, or the, you know, Viz has its own streaming service, and, you know, they're just a lot more availability. So I think a lot of that, yeah, you're right, is available to people, and they can kind of either go back to that nostalgia, or if their kid's finding it now, you know, they have access to it.
Yeah. And that's good. If it gets, you know, people interested in the material that they may eventually shift over to reading the stuff, that's a win. Or can be a win. For it to actually be a win, they actually have to shift over. That just doesn't happen that much.
Yeah. No, I think I'm more and more convinced that there are people like me and you who truly enjoy the comics medium as a way to express stories, and the format. I don't even speak to paper versus digital. I'm just talking about the comics format. And maybe it's because we just got hit at the right time in life to pick it up. But I think the vast majority of people that interact with any of this material, if they just see the movies or they just watch the TV shows, that is the only thing they need, and they could care less.
I think the other thing that is long-term going to really hurt the comic book industry is the decline of the comic strip industry.
You know, that's a very good point, because you're absolutely right. My dad grew up, and he every time the Sunday paper would come, he would race over there. He'd hand the sports section to his dad, and then he would take the comic strip section and read it. And that was when he was a kid. I vaguely remember when I was a kid going through the comics a couple times, but it was never like a central part of my life every Sunday or anything like that. But you're absolutely right. There are whole generations that was like a huge part of their formative childhood.
Yeah, for me, Dad every Sunday would have gone out, gotten the paper, get it out. Once he'd gone through the comic section, he'd put that, you know, off to the side for everyone else in the family to go through. And us kids would kind of fight over that. Matter of fact, there was, this is in San Diego, there was the Union and the Tribune. So he got both papers because he's big on the news stuff. That didn't carry to my generation, of course. But that meant there were two Sunday funnies to do. And that, I think, also, you know, cut down some of the fighting a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But just reading, whether it's Peanuts, whether it's The Far Side, mm-hmm. Calvin and Hobbes, Bloom Country, you know, whatever, you get awareness of the comic storytelling style.
Mm-hmm.
Be it captions, thought balloons, the order to read the panels in. Granted, it's very easy when there's only like two rows at most. But these days, people aren't kind of acclimatized to that growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So seeking out comic books is a bit more of a stretch. And even if they do find them, the the language and the muscle memory on how to read them isn't as developed.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the problem is, I think it's also not as developed with some storytellers, such that it's harder to read some comics.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons that while the grid layout certainly has some advantages to it, you put two pages like that together telling a scene in the same setting, and this would happen to me periodically on the Powers comics, where they'd have one of those interrogation room scenes. I'd hit the top row, hit the page break, and it's like, well, do I go down? Do I go to the other page? Is it a two-page spread? Is it not? I'm confused. And it would be slow-paced enough back-and-forth dialogue that it was hard to tell which direction to go.
Uh-huh.
And I consider myself an experienced comic book reader.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I could see somebody not as experienced getting completely perplexed. So I think that's one of those outside factors that has a long-term impact on the acceptance level of reading comics, both the Sunday Funnies type stuff, and also, I mean, that gives you the format and the structure of the story, but then having the properties either on cartoons, movies, whatever, gives you access to the content, and it's getting the melding of the two to get people to actually read comics that's frankly just not happening these days,
mm-hmm.
which does not bode well for the future of comics.
Yeah, I would agree that is something to be worried about for sure.
I mean, I think we're going to have a lot of people who love these characters but aren't aware and frankly don't care that comics are produced and originated these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I remember one story that Peter David has told. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure it was in his But I Digress column in Comic Buyer's Guide, where he was talking to some kid. I forget if it was a friend of his kid's or whatever. Kid had a Spider-Man shirt on, and he's like, I write the Spider-Man comics. And the kid's attitude was like they had taken a movie character and adapted it to comic books.
Oh, wow.
And didn't realize the character originated in comics.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like reading the Ready Player One book thinking it was an adaptation of the movie.
Yeah, that's problematic. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, if we dive into the top list itself, number one item on the list this time around is Venom by Donny Cates, Volume 1, trade paperback, 4,854 units. Donny Cates, particularly his Venom stuff, is doing very well on the monthly comic side.
Mm-hmm.
Not too surprising it topped the list here. Did it with under 5,000 units, but again, unless we've got a new volume of Walking Dead or, you know, a handful of other titles, it's not surprising for the top of this list to be under 5,000 units.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is the next one, which is the Thanos Infinity Conflict original graphic novel hardcover. It did 4,546 units, and what's interesting is it is an original graphic novel.
Yeah.
We don't get, I think, enough of those. I think at one point Marvel and DC were experimenting a bit more with them. I think Marvel's probably, well, you've got the Earth One stuff, so I think they're still doing some stuff with it. But typically, the collected editions are just that, collected editions of previously published material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that this and the Venom by Donny Cates is kind of neck and neck, because Donny Cates was the one who told the Thanos story that was in the monthly comic that kind of, I think, cheesed off Jim Starlin, because it was similar-ish enough to what he was doing, yet it was going to come out first, even though his story was in progress first.
Gotcha.
And that's just bad on editorial. When you've got two stories that are covering the same narrative ground, I think that whether they cannibalize each other's sales or not, it's just not a good idea.
Yeah. Well, it just speaks to there should be a little bit more communication on the editor team.
I'm not even sure if it was necessarily a team of editors that was involved in that.
Yeah, touche, right? Yeah.
I hope so. I hope so. If it was one person doing it, it's like, come on. But I'm of the mindset that upsetting your talent like that's never a good idea. But you can't just kowtow to them either, so there's a balance to be had.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, everything is below 4,000 units. Again, not too big of a surprise. There were a few things a little lower on the list that did better than I was expecting them to do.
Yeah, quick question for you. Number four, Black Eyed Peas presents Master Sun Zombies Chronicles. What is that?
Well, that's the Black Eyed Peas presents the Master Sun Zombie Chronicles. What more do you add? No, I don't know.
Not only that, but it's a reorder, And at first, when I saw that reorder numbers with the total sales, I thought, oh, they must have discounted it because it didn't sell well and they wanted to get rid of it quickly. But the retail rank isn't super discounted. So it's interesting. I mean, is that a book of covers? Like, you know how they did those like hip hop cover themed, and did they do one for Black Eyed Peas? I don't really. That seems very strange to me.
This is an actual story.
Oh, it is? Like by the band or what?
From the mind of Will I Am.
Okay.
And I have not read this. I do not have this. I do not know details about this. And it makes me wonder if it's a new printing that is somehow more relevant than it was, because this originally came out in, I think, July of last year.
Oh.
But I really, again, I think this is another original graphic novel. I'm not certain.
Oh, that would probably make more sense and it's priced about right, $24.99 for that. Okay. That makes sense. Like they did a project with the band, or the band had an idea and they thought it would be good to try and reach that audience, you know, a different audience. And so they, you know, that makes sense.
Yeah. But that was one that it's like, which of these is not like the others sort of a thing.
Yeah. Well, I just was reading the title and I was like, what is that?
Yeah. There are sometimes a couple of these things on the list that it's like, I didn't realize that existed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, especially with 500 items, and like you said, that's not even everything that was published. It's hard to know about everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and some of the stuff can be from like 20, 30 years back.
Absolutely.
So staying up on just what's on this list every month is impossible, I think. I was surprised that the Star Wars Lando Double or Nothing trade did, 2,430 units there at rank 9. The Star Wars stuff seems to have cooled a bit over on the comic side. But the one that really surprised me was right below it was Domino Volume 1 Killer Instinct trade paperback, 2,365. I've read those issues. I mean, the art's great. The story, Domino, I mean, yeah, she was in Deadpool 2 and stuff, I believe. Still haven't watched that. Need to. But not kind of a headliner character, by and large. And some of the other ones they put in that story, C and D list kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
So for this to get something that, in theory, most stores could have a copy on average, not that they do, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It did better than I would have expected.
Gotcha.
You know, other stuff above it where we've got more reorder activity for the Batman White Knight stuff of 2,979 units. That's been getting a lot of good buzz. They're retroactively putting it into the Black Label imprint. So it continuing to do well, not a big shock.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the Black Label stuff, down at rank 28, we've got All-Star Superman now as part of the Black Label stuff, 1,523 units. It's funny, I would have branded that more as an Elseworlds kind of a story.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe now Black Label and Elseworlds can overlap. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's still new management is settling in, so you'll probably still see some rearranging the deck chairs. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think trying to build up this Black Label with retroactive population of previously published material, not the best of ideas.
Well, and the thing that doesn't even make sense to me is All-Star Superman is considered one of the most is in my opinion it's my favorite Superman story, but I never really regarded it as a edgy, dark version of it. I actually thought it was a pretty positive take on Superman. So, my understanding of the Black Label was that it would be more adult entered. It was basically like trying to rebrand Vertigo without the stigma that has happened to Vertigo lately of not being able to sell anything new.
Yeah, I think the big problem is the identity of what it means to be Black Label is unclear.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've also gone with, oh, it's creative freedom. Well, is it creative freedom in a dark tone, in a more positive tone? I mean, they're very different things.
Well, especially with that, the whole Batman thing, and you know, like they have certain books that go one direction, and you're right, then they have other books like this All-Star Superman that were, they're already published works that kind of have their own identity, and you're kind of trying to shoehorn it in. It doesn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, I think that the marketing and the brand identification and stuff around Black Label is already a train wreck, with really very few things, only, you know, two original things out for it, with the two volumes of Batman Damned.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest, having read both of them, I have not been impressed. It's not for me, and if that's a defining mark of the Black Label imprint, that steers me away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny, because I really enjoyed All-Star Superman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I really don't know where they're going on some of that.
Well, I guess we'll see in the next few months.
Yeah. Now, the top retail ranking item was down at rank 34, and it was the X-Men Massacre Omnibus Hardcover, 1,417 units at a $100 price point. So it did pretty well, and Mutant Massacre was a big storyline back in the, is that the 80s or the 90s? I'm going to say the 90s, but I'm not sure. It had some definite changes to a couple of the key X-Men characters back at the time. Going a little further down to rank 48, we've got Immortal Men, The End of Forever trade paperback, which is quite possibly containing, I think, the end of that series, because I'm trying to remember if that went any further than the six issues. I think it didn't. That was one of the many New Age of Heroes properties, and I'm going to argue not one of the more successful ones. And on average, I'm going to say half the stores out there got a copy, which is frankly a little more than I would have expected.
Yeah, I think I haven't heard great things about that stuff in general. So I haven't read any of it, to be honest with you.
I'm maybe an issue or two behind on like Sideways or whatever, but I've read all of it, and most of it is forgettable. They have taken one of the characters further than I would have expected in one area. But I don't know what motivated that either. But with some of these, and I'm thinking it was either Immortal Men or The Unexpected, it was clearly a bit of a premature end of the series and teased that we will see these characters potentially elsewhere. Not that I think we really need to.
I
thought from the beginning the New Age of Heroes was a bit of a fool's errand. I mean, getting new properties out there is a good thing. Getting rebranded Marvel properties out there as DC properties, not so much. And if you look at every other attempt over the last, I'm going to say 20 years, to do this new wave of titles and have any of them really catch on, historically, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the, I'm trying to think of, I mean, there was the M-Tech line over at Marvel. There was, I mean, the Young Bloods characters or New Blood characters or whatever, I guess it was, New Blood, at times at DC. You had the Young Animals line. And just at various points, you can see here's a big push to get this grouping of titles out there, and most of them just flounder. I think it's too competitive of a market, and to go with a bunch of new characters, which is good to get some new characters out there, if they were truly new and looked like they would catch on. But man, if I had to be in the room to greenlight most of those sorts of projects, be it from New Age of Heroes or almost any of these other lines, I think a lot of them I probably would have passed on. There were some I would have tried, but I think I would have gone with focus on the promotion for that individual title, not link it to a bunch of other things that may act as an anchor on. But these days, getting a new title out there in any way, shape, or form and having it succeed is really a Herculean task.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the problem I had with a big part of it was, is it felt like such a reaction to, they were initially, like when it was first conceived, and maybe they were kicking the idea around before they announced anything. But I thought it was also kind of like a reaction to all the comments Marvel had about artists don't sell, and you know, that, remember that whole scenario?
Yeah, that's an argument that comes up every so often of, oh, you've got to be story based. Oh, it's the artist that push the stuff. You got to go back to basics. You got to do a bold new direction. There are just various pendulums that swing back and forth over time in the comic industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think neither extreme is inherently right or wrong. There are times where you need to go back to basics because you veered so much from what the character always kind of has been and what the audience accepts them as. And there are other times where doing a bit of a new direction is the right choice. I mean, mm-hmm. the Venom by Donny Cates is taking the character in a different direction, yet staying true to the history of the character versus just throwing it out lock, stock, and barrel. And I think that's clearly working.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that if it works, it's worth the time, but I don't know.
Yeah, but any title you put out there, I think, has at least an 80%, probably a 90% chance of failure within a year period.
Yeah, that's true. And the way the cycles go, yeah.
Yeah, the ones that go past that tend to be properties that have been around for 50, 60, 70, 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not a foundational aspect of the Marvel or DC universe and the character gets a title, the odds of that character still having that title, much less with that creative team, in 18 to 24 months is practically zero.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you are a foundational aspect of those universes, the odds aren't that great. And I think it's that lack of stability, which is continuing to reinforce that trend. Because mm-hmm. if you realize, well, I don't like this, I'll just wait till they revamp it, get on board the next time they go do Moon Knight or Ghost Rider, or they just started up, Martian Manhunter, Hawkman, we'll get a Firestorm probably in another year or two. There are certain go-to characters that they keep trying to get out there. And most of these characters have had a period where they had like a 100-issue run of Firestorm, or a lengthy solid run for Moon Knight or something.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to recapture that makes sense. It just, you know, you get one of those for every six that peter out within a year or two.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a tough market. And
yeah,
it's one of those that you look at how some of these things are doing and you wonder, well, are they going to go back to the well on this? I'd like them to. And you look at the numbers and it's like, well, probably not. Case in point, rank 102, we've got Future Quest Presents Volume 2 trade paperback, 786 units.
Oh, and that's not reorder. That's painful.
That's new.
Yeah.
I like the Future Quest stuff. I'd like to see them do more with it. At those numbers, not sure they will.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a shame, because they'll let the property cool off for a bit and then try to relaunch it, maybe, if we're lucky, in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But disregarding what they've done here, possibly. And I think, again, every time they do that, it's like, well, why should I get invested in this if they're not going to stay invested? So,
yeah, it's interesting. You're absolutely right that it is a tough market out there. In another instance of that, a good segue for a little bit of a discussion about a recent publisher, Rank 49 from Lion Forge Water Snakes. I think that's their best-selling item this month, at least on the trade side. And actually, I like this artist works. Tony Sandoval is the person that put out this. It's like a original graphic novel, I believe. But the reason I brought the Lion Forge up is I wanted to just have a discussion. You know, we've seen over the last couple of years a number of publishers kind of establishing themselves, or at least trying to. Aftershock, Lion Forge. You can kind of tell that there's some serious resources, or at least people that are, you know, attempting to make a go of it with multiple books, multiple creators, and offering, you know, what, when you read from these creators, good deals, good percentages on the properties, you know, not as good obviously as Image, because, you know, that's its own thing, but still much more creator friendly than, say, Image or than Marvel and DC. And then we had seen Lion Forge do a number of expansions. Not only they have their own superhero universe, they have they're doing a bunch of graphic novels, and basically they'll buy the rights to some European graphic novels, bring them over here, translate them, and put them out. They were acquiring different properties. I think they Magnetic Press. They acquired a bunch of different. You know, there was just a general sense of expansion, and they were putting out quite a bit for its size, pound for pound, quite a bit of kids comics and like young kids comics too. I think they had a separate imprint called Lion like Kids or Kids Club or something like that, where it was basically almost for, you know, beginner readers, kind of comics for real young kids, being like 5 to 10 years old, not even the normal young kid comics that adults can kind of read. And then, you know, recently we were like, wow, I hope they're having enough sales to back up all this expansion, because they, you know, they were having multiple pages and previews, and, you know, to solicit all those books and to pay everyone, it seemed like that's quite a bit of outgoing expense. So hopefully things are matching up on the sales. And, you know, I don't remember us seeing any huge hits out of Lion Forge, at least on the collected edition side. And obviously they're are having some financial struggles, because they have recently announced some layoffs and some restructuring. So, you know, we talk all the time about how to make money in comics is start with a lot of money and then you end up with less. And yeah. I think that Lion Forge is kind of going through that. They clearly had someone or a group of someone who it had invested with the hopes of expansion, and it looks like they're having to rethink some of that, at least. I'm not necessarily saying they're going away, but it looks like they're having some issues.
I think they're going to try to stay around as long as they can. I think this is clearly a passion project for somebody. And mm-hmm. I really have not looked too deep into the backstory of Lion Forge and such. I mean, I've seen them at cons. I've talked to a few people at them. It San Diego and stuff over the years. But the direction they've gone over the years has kind of been a bit scattershot in terms of early on they did kind of digest-sized quasi-graphic novels for Punky Brewster, Knight Rider, Airwolf, maybe Miami Vice?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things that, and the it was almost a kid-friendly version of nostalgia properties.
Yeah.
Which is a bizarre kind of juxtaposition. You know, what kid is going to be aware of Airwolf or Knight Rider, yet still kind of, I don't say reading at that level, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Accepting of that sort of more simplified storytelling or whatever. And then they went from there, they started doing the, and I forget the timeline on this, but like the Catalyst Prime stuff's been going at least a year or two now. They bought out Magnetic Press. Okay, that sort of made sense. Because I think Magnetic Press has done some great stuff, and certainly keeping that as a separate imprint to do the more European stuff makes sense. The acquisition of The Beat I thought was very interesting. I don't see how that really furthered their comic book publishing agenda, and I think there's the potential for conflict of interests there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, certainly Heidi's a professional and from what I've seen is pretty good about disclosing the ownership stuff whenever, you know, Lionforge comes up in a story or something like that, as to, you know, at least have that transparency there, and I respect that. But, again, I don't know how that, having The Beat, which is a comic book news and review outlet, furthers and enhances the comic book publishing side of things. And the publisher they are now versus the publisher they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago is fairly different. And when you're coming out with, let's see, there's 6 or 7 titles in the Catalyst Prime line that are doing okay, but not really burning up the charts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious how much money somebody has sunk into this and what sort of return on that investment, be it financial or emotional, they're expecting to get.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're also doing 1 or 2 licensed properties like Voltron, which I this month on the comic side was the best selling of the bunch for them by a fairly wide margin. But yeah, a lot of their stuff over on the Catalyst Prime line is selling, you know, in the hundreds of units range, not the thousands of units range.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a publisher that I think definitely wants to be in the comic book game. So I don't see them going away anytime soon if they can prevent that. But yeah, when we're seeing the numbers we're seeing for them, just the cost of being at San Diego seems like a hefty PR expense that you got to question if they can truly afford.
Yeah, and that's why I was hoping that, you know, because they are doing so many different kids comics, that maybe we didn't see a bulk of their sales that they may have been having in different places like at Amazon or at the Scholastic Book Fair or things like that. And they had, you know, seemed to have, at least in the previews write-ups, they seemed to have, you know, at least they said that they had a lot of publicity outreach and whatnot. And, you know, you could always say, well, that's just the company saying that it has those things. Who knows if it's actually following up afterwards. But it seemed like they had a plan and a dedicated idea. It's just a super tough market, especially if you're not one of the established players, and the person who was funding it may just have realized that they didn't want to keep taking that risk or keep funding it, you know?
Well, let's take a look at the potential of they had that game plan, they had that idea, because I think they have multiple times. Because I think the game plan of let's do these Punky Brewster, Airwolf, Knight Rider things is one distinct game plan going in one direction,
mm-hmm.
which I think is very different than the let's acquire Magnetic Press, do these European adaptations, translate them, get them out there, because that's a very much more sophisticated sort of storytelling and stuff like that than the Punky Brewster, Airwolf, Knight Rider stuff. And compare and contrast both of those to the let's do our own superhero-ish line with Catalyst Prime, which seems to be in yet another different direction. So I'm not seeing a clear game plan that kind of is unifying those different approaches both over time and even concurrently with Magnetic Press and Catalyst Prime. I guess I just don't get where their head is at, what they're trying to big picture wise,
mm-hmm.
and how these pieces are falling in line to that. I think the original stuff that they just continued with the Punky Brewster and stuff was a let's do something different than everybody else. That didn't work. They retrenched, revectored. But I don't think that now, you know, two-ish years into the Catalyst Prime stuff, they've had enough success there to really warrant continuing with it long-term.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why it will be interesting to see what their plan for 2019 is and see if they're going to kind of cull some of their, you know, if they're going to shrink that superhero universe or they're going to double down on it and shrink some of the other stuff that they were focusing on, or yeah, it will be interesting.
Well, and again, where does the Beat fall into all of this?
Well, and that was the other thing I was thinking is, you know, is that going to become a cost casualty or what? I don't know.
I'm not understanding how it benefits them to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Beat is a fine website. I got no problems with it and such. I do think it's kind of better off being in a more neutral position than being owned by one of the publishers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say they can't make it work. Clearly they are, but I just personally, it's not the approach I would have taken. But regardless of the Beat's stand on it, which I have, again, no problem with, I think, again, like I said, Heidi's a professional, knows what she's doing and stuff, and doing things the right way under the circumstances. I'm not seeing what Lionforge is getting out of the relationship. Why did they acquire it? It's not like they now have an in-house bunch of reviewers that they can give advanced copies of as a focus group or something that's giving them the great selling titles that every other publisher seems to have elude them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, I think even such a focus group approach is almost doomed to failure, because I think every time we look, particularly this time of year when the best of the year lists are starting to come out, we look at what the, be it the podcasters, the media reviewers, or whomever are picking as their best of the year, and a lot of us are looking at it saying, okay, I see two or three of these and they make sense, but where did some of these others come from? And of course, everybody's going to have their own list of what they think is the best and should continue, and that's great. That's part of why we've got such a diverse marketplace out there. But I look at the critical darlings of the industry versus what's actually selling. And if you were to use any group of reviewers, they'll pick their critical darling. They're not going to steer you to what the audience in mass is actually going to get behind and support whole hog.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, there's aspects of what Lionforge is doing I don't understand, but they've clearly got deep pockets, although not infinitely deep, obviously now, and a clear passion for comics. And that goes a long way, but partnering it with a really good game plan helps.
Yeah. Well, and you know, in any particular business, there's risk, you know, and you can have a great business plan and you can try and execute it, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, maybe they're just come, and we've talked so many times about comics is just so tough in general. So
I think with comics, not only is there risk to a publisher going in, but there's an unpredictability of the reader and retailer base.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, there are aspects that I think are very predictable. Certain things you're going to do are going to cheese off the readers and the retailers, and that's going to hurt sales. But then there's other stuff that you may think, wow, given what's happened, they're going to really love this, and they upend the table out of disgust for some reason, you know? Mm-hmm. It's such a mercurial marketplace that things that on paper look like they would do good, because when like the new 52 came out, when the Rebirth round of titles, or you know, post Civil War, you know, whenever Marvel or DC would have a, or any other publisher would have a, here's what we're going to come out with. We've got these creators. Here's the pitch stuff. You look at it and it's like, wow, this title, it's a great writer. It's a great artist. It's a cool concept. That'll do great. And it tanks, you know, or it does okay, you know, but it's, there have been a number of things that on paper looked good, but man, by the time the pavement hit the whatever the right metaphor would be there, by the time the book came out, it just, either enough time had elapsed, the coolness had worn off, or it just wasn't a solid execution. So it's a crazy tough marketplace, and, you know, more and more publishers seem to want to get into it. TKO seems to be a new one these days, and they're going to go direct to stores, it looks like. It was talked about on the Slack channel. They've already got a couple of comics where you can read the first issues, and I'll be honest, I looked at the first round of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
None of them piqued my interest enough to say, wow, I really got to go read that right now. Now, the second round actually had one or two I would have, but they're not available yet.
Mm. Is that the one that also they're having different size, like prestige format, or?
That I don't know. I didn't look enough into the print version to know if they were going to be different size. It was, yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. Because I thought I read an article about another company that was deciding to do do like they were also starting up and they were, you know, not necessarily going to follow the regular size for comics and things like that. And yeah, you know, you see some experimentation, but you see a lot of that stuff is just going to be on so on the margins that it's going to be very hard for them to get a foothold.
Anyone who says I'm not going to do a regular size comic, if you're going to go magazine size, I'll give a little bit of a break for that. But really anything else, my first question is why? What's the inherent benefit of a different size that overwhelms every other inherent disadvantage? It's not going to fit in comic boxes. It's not going to fit in comic bags. Okay, that already annoys the collector, so they can't put it with the rest of their collection. Oh, guess what? Any store that's got dividers on their comic rack that are comic size to go fit the different books, suddenly your comic doesn't fit there either. Mm-hmm. Oh, you want to do yours on the sides because you could do a widescreen comic. Well, it's not going to stand upright. They're not going to have room to put it, you know, horizontally. And even if they do, now you're only going to have a tiny sliver of the thing even visible. And it's now taking up two slots versus one slot. Where are these imaginary benefits that are the impetus to doing a different size to shake things up?
Mm.
And I'm not saying the current size is great, perfect, or even good, but it's standard.
Yeah.
It just, every time they try to, any publisher tries to shake things up by doing stuff like that, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. Even when Barrier came out in print from Image, and it was just a little taller than everything else. So it doesn't really fit in the bags and the boards right, or in the comic boxes and stuff. Or as much as I'm not into the collectability aspect of it, it is a collectible item.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so running counter to that just seems fish. But they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah, and we'll see how their sales are. Well, that's for sure.
I think even the most successful of odd-sized comics, when it ceased being successful, it was pretty much completely forgotten. The example that comes to my mind is Mouse Guard.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to bet most people, before I said Mouse Guard, were like, what's he talking about? And when I said Mouse Guard, it's, oh, yeah, I remember that now. Because they'd forgotten about it. But that also goes to the short-term memory of the comic readership, that if it's not coming out, the half-life of the memory of that item is pretty short, and often 6 months, a year, certainly 2 years later, poof, gone. And until somebody mentions it, you'd be hard-pressed to name it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it's another factor of just so much stuff coming out every month. The new properties are pushing out the memory of the old ones. I mean, if I were to ask a hardcore Marvel fan, name the X-Men and Marvel titles that were coming out 7 years ago, they'd have to stop and think what was going on 7 years ago. Okay, would it have been Mighty Avengers, Uncanny Avengers, Avengers, you know, which variant of the Avenger titles were?
Mm-hmm.
And now if you were to ask what were the solo Avenger titles going on, and can you get the title correct? Was it Thor, Mighty Thor, you know, Unworthy Thor, you know, whatever? Which variant of Iron Man or Captain America? These are the sorts of things that slowly chip away at sales and at readership.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to keep track of the stuff. And if we go to rank... Well, or go ahead.
No, you were saying?
I was going to say, if we go to rank 137, we can find another forgettable one. And that was Quicksilver No Surrender trade paperback, 621 units.
Oh, wow.
This is a character that's been an X-Men and an Avenger and hangs around with the Inhumans. That's three franchises anchoring this character, or helping support this character. Been in the movies for both the X-Men and the Avengers. This spun out of the No Surrender storyline, and in trade, it did 621 units. That's not particularly impressive. And I'm not going to say the story was particularly impressive either. Frankly, don't think it was. It makes you wonder, you know, are these miniseries they do on some of these characters, is there really an interest in it? I think that... Yeah. Title on the comic side started around 20,000 and quickly fell below 10,000.
Well, and I think it goes back to what you were saying about so many of the series that you ended up dropping was they were just playing for time and they weren't actually advancing the story. I think a lot of these side stories are, I'm going to be honest with you, I think Marvel puts out because they have, you know, they built up this system where they have to put out 50 to 75 books a month and they've got to have something. And because so many of their series are selling low enough that they have to start new series so frequently, they're always looking for a new character to at least get 5 to 6 issues out of, even if there's almost no demand for it. You know what I mean? But they need to have that title to maintain the space on the shelf and or, you know, pay for all of the people that are, you know, the overhead. So,
or just from a editorial point of view, if you don't have a full slate, why are you there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's again, it's another way the market's just a rough thing. And I certainly don't expect every title out of every editorial office to be a smash hit. And there are times where, okay, let's give this character a chance to see if there's an audience for them. But there's so many of these that just out of the gate, you know that they're going to eventually, once they finish, they're going to wind up in a back issue bin forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a small fan base that's just nuts about the title, but that's because they like the artist or the writer or the character or whatever. But by and large, that story makes no impact on continuity or the marketplace. Just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, it's almost like they're not even really concerned with they just need to get to the next month and get to the next month, and so they just keep going.
Well, and there's a keep the trains running on time, which is nice if the trains are running on time, but then there's a matter of, are you really building to anything? Are you making progress? Are you doing anything to grow your readership and the loyalty of that readership?
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got these things that are, for lack of a better term, throwaway comics, I really question if you're better off not doing them. And I just don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's many people that have talked about there just needs to be less single issue comics, but they're kind of trapped. We've talked about them being trapped in this, on the treadmill that they've created, where they have to keep publishing them just to keep the revenue, not even profit. We're talking about just revenue coming through the door to keep it going, you know?
Well, and it's not just their revenue, it's the comic store revenue.
Yeah.
You know, if Marvel were to wake up and decide, you know what, they're going to make more money if they cut half their titles. Well, that half as many comics going through, Marvel comics going through your average store is not going to help the average store.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that side to think about. Now, whether they think about that or not, I'm not so sure. But then the other thing Marvel is doing that I think is worth talking about a little bit is I think they're doing some titles that are digital and then straight to trade.
Interesting.
Because we've got at rank 25, Spidey Schools Out, MPGN, which is, I don't know what the MP stands for. I'm assuming GN for graphic novel. And I'm pretty sure this, I know this is the first time in print, and I'm pretty sure it was a digital project first. We go down to rank 47. We've got the Luke Cage MPGN Everyman trade paperback. They've also done a few others. Matter of fact, I think as we record this, Cloak and Dagger just had one of these come out. These are stories they're doing in digital first, kicking out a trade and such. So, not totally an original graphic novel, but first time in print.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm curious how those are doing for it and where they are getting the money to do the digital version. Are they doing it on the digital sales? Are these things going through the Digital Comics Unlimited route? Because to me, that's a very different thing. If it's coming through the Digital Comics Unlimited and the subscription base is paying for the new content, that's a bit of a game changer, I think, potentially. If it's we can sell this well enough in digital to have it hang on or whatever, not as much of a game changer, but still good.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a different approach than what DC had done historically with their digital stuff, which is go digital, two issues get collected in print, so many of the print get into trade, so many of the trade go into a collected edition, or, you know, omnibus or what have you. Because
mm-hmm.
Lord knows they've reprinted the Injustice stories, I mean, multiple different ways. And that seems to have worked out for them, although not so well that they're, well enough that they continued it for 5-6 years or whatever, maybe 7.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if there's an Injustice 3 game coming. I hope there is, so they'll keep the comic going. Or just keep going with the universe regardless of the game.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, but definitely a lot of different things out there. The other thing to talk about real quick is that $200 item from Marvel. It was X-Men and Adamantium Collection hardcover. This is reorder. It says it's reorder activity, but it didn't seem to pick up the sales from the last time around, which might have been in 2014. I'm curious what's going on with this one. This is reprinting a lot of X-Men stuff, going as far back as the original X-Men 1 in 57 to 59. And I think it's just a lot of stories that were both classic and in a couple of cases leveraged for movie storylines, because we get things like the Days of Future Past, God Love, Man Kills, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, $200 price points, pretty serious chunk of change.
Yeah, I mean, and those are even bigger than those size, I think they're even bigger than Absolutes, right? They're kind of almost coffee table, huge, huge books, as I remember. Because I remember they solicited, they started a series of those and they did a few, but they were so pricey and so big, I don't think as many people bought them as they wanted them to. And so I don't think that they've been pushing them as hard. I think these are kind of, maybe they're just trying to get rid of them. I don't know.
That could be. It's hard to tell. I do think, again, the bigger the item is, the harder it is to store, and therefore the fewer of them you can get.
Yeah, I kind of remember when I was looking at these in previews, they're the size of the artist editions, but you know how the artist editions are usually between like 100 and 200 pages. But these are like omnibus size, but this, you know, in terms of length, so 500 to 1,000 pages, but the size of an artist edition. So you can imagine the size of that.
I can imagine the weight of that. Is it coupled to forklift?
Well, exactly. And just imagine the shipping charges on that, too.
I was going through my artist editions recently, and I've got at least a dozen of them, probably over that, probably closer to 16 or 17. And those things just, they take up a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're nice. I'm happy to have them, but I'm glad they slow down the release of them, or at least the release of the ones I was interested in, because it's hard to find room for them.
Yeah, and they're definitely, the size of them makes them, you have to have a specific place for them for sure.
Yeah, yeah. There are certain things I've got in as part of my comic collection hobby, not necessarily the part of the collection itself, but some of the hardcovers or whatnot that are just odd sized and therefore finding a place for them. Again, I've got my Mouse Guard comics away from my regular comics because they just don't fit in the box right.
Uh-huh.
I've got the artist edition off in one area. Some of the other crazy kind of hardcovers, like the Anomaly hardcovers that are wide and such, are in their own little place. Then you've got things like the price guides that are more bookish sized than comic size and stuff. It's hard to find a uniform place. And of course, trades, unlike manga that tend to be more standardized sizes, my collection of trades is, you know, haphazard when you look at it, just because every other one's a different size.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing just bugs me.
Yeah, that's the rhyme and reason on trade dress a lot of times does not make any sense.
Yeah, yeah. I get wanting to refresh the branding in the trade dress and shake it up or whatever, but I think there's also an aspect of conformity that makes things look nicer on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I look over at my bookcase over there of trades, you know, I've got them in alphabetical order, and the different Marvel ones are different heights. It seems like there are rarely a bunch that are in a row that feel either uniform in height or even depth of the thing. And it makes the bookcase look more chaotic than it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm saying that should be a major thing they should be thinking about when saying, what do we reprint or whatever, but certainly something to give some thought to when they decide what format they reprint.
Mm-hmm.
Yet other stuff, like I've got a sizable collection of the official handbooks of the Marvel Universe that have a nice uniform trade dress and everything, and they look great. Same with the essentials and such. So it can be done. So what else looked interesting to you on the list?
Let's see here. What else did I highlight? We talked about the Lion Forge. I did see, what I find interesting is just, you know, a lot of the reorder activity, some of the reorder activity, you'll see it like 200 units, and it depending on how long it's been out, is that just stores ordering when they have actual orders from customers, or is that stores restocking? You know, I almost wonder about like for reorder activity, if the top of the list for a month is, let's say, 5,000, and you have reorder activity at between 500 and 1,000 units, or reorder activity at 200 units, is that restocking after sales, or is that actual like customer comes in, you don't have an order? You know, I wonder if there's a kind of like almost like a different classes of that. You know what I mean?
I think there's at least two distinct cases to be had there. One is does Diamond have it in stock or not, really, is what it boils down
to. Yeah, that is that too, yeah.
Because if they've got it in stock, there could be something that could get, if this list went infinitely deep, could get on the list with a single unit.
Mm-hmm.
But if Diamond doesn't have it in stock, it's got to be a big enough thing for them to justify filling the back order.
Because
we've all heard the story of somebody wanted to go get something, their store wanted to get it for them, the publisher wanted to get it to them, but Diamond wouldn't cut a PO because it was just for a copy or two, and that's not enough to justify cutting the PO.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get the cost-benefit analysis there, but it means that there's a certain amount of pent-up demand that can't be met, which is just kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also the matter of, with some of this stuff, if you sell your copy of something, you want to get another copy. You know, you sell that Joker hardcover, it's probably worth getting another copy. It's Joker, biggest Batman villain, Batman's always hot.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem like a major risk. You sell that last copy you had of some middle-of-the-road DC book, and is it really worth getting that next copy of it? Geez, I don't know. And I'm trying to find a good example here on the list of what I would say would fall into that category. And really, most of what I'm seeing on the DC side are ones where I could see if you'd sold your last copy, yeah, it makes sense to get the other one. But I think then we get up towards that area where there's the more newer stuff, and I think once you sell that trade of, say, the current Green Arrow thing, maybe you don't replace it.
Yeah.
You know, it gets kind of fuzzy. But we've got stuff as low as 177 units on this list this time around, if we look at the full list, because it actually goes down to 503 units because we had a multi-way tie there at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this time of year, I think some stores are going to get, you know, another copy or two of things that they think they could sell during the holiday season. You know, this is not a bad time to make sure you've got the different, you know, major event reprints or whatever from Marvel and DC or whatever kind of the hot titles are, just to make sure people can get those.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, you're kind of restocking what you need for the holiday.
Yeah, well, and, you know, what movies are coming up, what TV shows are getting interest, you know, what characters have the buzz, and, you know, can you capitalize on that or not? And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is one of those cases where if there was really a strong carryover from what's on TV to, you know, what's on this list, I think we would have seen better sales for Titans, Green Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, Black Lightning. That's just on the DC side. Again, you can carry this to other stuff over on Marvel with the movies. The movies tend to have a little bit more obvious of a carry-through because they tend to be focused on a more singular story.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we see that kind of translation of sales, but I do think it makes people more predisposed to be willing to read comics, or at least more interested in the characters, which helps.
Yeah. There's another one that I found interesting, mostly because I got this item as well. At rank 260, the American Vampire Omnibus. It's listed as a volume one, but I haven't actually looked at the table of contents to see if it contains everything or if there's going to be any other. But this was a series that kind of finished up from Scott Snyder and Raphael Albuquerque almost maybe a year and a half ago. And now they're putting out the Omnibus, and the sales aren't great. And I'm wondering if they waited too long, and because of the turnover of everything, you know, once something is out of people's minds, it's just, you know, it's out of their minds. And so, you know, this is reorder activity of 347. I think this is one of those omnibuses that was solicited a good 6 to 8 months before it was actually released. So then you have additional orders come in, kind of thing. So I don't know if that's really reorder activity, because I just remember getting mine last month. So I don't know how it would have reorder activity.
That's a great question. I wonder if there was a different omnibus before.
Oh, and then they canceled it and resolicited, kind of thing.
Or maybe not even canceled it, but it actually came out and maybe it wasn't this full omnibus or whatever. Because one of the things they tend to do on the trade side is reuse names.
Yeah, that's true. But this was a Vertigo series that was a creator-owned, so I don't think that there's... since it's a series that I was really interested in, like I really liked it, I was waiting for this omnibus to come out. But just interesting that it says reorder activity, because I thought I ordered that I got it last month. I know that. So.
Well, again, we're looking at the November data, and this came out the last day of October.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So if I pull up the October numbers, we may see it doing like 500 units over there.
Ah, okay. So the sales might be better than I thought, because, you know, it also is an omnibus, a $99 item. It's not like it's cheap, so you can't be expecting this to sell 5,000 to 10,000 units. But they put this out so far removed from when the original material was coming out. You know what I mean? And it's just interesting to see if there was the reason it didn't sell as well as I would have hoped was because people just didn't remember, because it had been a year and a half since the material had come out.
Well, it's funny because it's at rank 260 this month, and it was at rank 250 last month with 459 units.
Oh, okay.
Now, that same 459 units this month would have put it at rank 198, I think.
Yeah, and there's that variability month to month.
Yeah, and that's, again, part of why you've got to look at the right thing if you're doing a month-to-month comparison. Because if you're looking at, well, it was this quantity rank this month and this quantity rank last month, and, you know, it must have gone up or down in sales or something. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, again, percentages from month to month depend on the size of the pie.
Absolutely.
But this is one where, because it came out on the last day of October, any mm-hmm. reorder activity it would have had, even advanced reorder activity, would have fallen into the next month.
Gotcha.
So, but yeah, there are a lot of things that, if they don't get the trade out or the collection out soon enough, I think they've missed the mark. Other times, I think they're coming out too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, well, why continue with the monthly version?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's one of those things where I think the timing of when they solicit and when they release, mm-hmm. there's an art form there, and I don't think it's a simple one.
No, I don't. I agree. And especially for the bigger books, right? So, like the omnibuses, you'll see Marvel do this. Like, you know, the standard previews is like 2 months out, 3 months, but for the big collections, you'll oftentimes see solicited for advanced solicit, and it's at least two order cycles, so almost 6 months usually before they'll do it. And they'll do that for the books that are anywhere from, you know, the omnibus up to the $150 ones. And it just, I think it honestly gives them more time to plan their print run so that they can really zero in on the demand and not overprint too much, because there's a cost associated with those big books, you know, especially with the shipping and everything.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. No, I think the heavier it is, the more they want to get that shipping estimate, you know, kind of accurate. And that makes sense, but it's there have been times where I'll see the solicitation for the final issue of something and then the regular trade or hardcover in that same order form, and I'm like, wow, that was fast.
Yeah.
But when you've got to have the regular issue, the trade, the hardcover, the omnibus, and the collected, you know, whatever editions between all of that, you gotta start soon on the collected editions to get those different variants of it out there.
Uh-huh.
So, but yeah, this is one where I think we had a lot of just kind of some lackluster sales. Not that surprising. Again, the bottom of the top 500 was 177 units. The bottom of the top 300 was 301 units, which, you know, is again lower than it was last month. Last month, the top 300 was 407 units, and the top 500 was 205. It's not radically different, but again, if you were to just look at the quantity ranking, and if that number goes up or down, equating that to the sales going up or down, you really just can't.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I go to the trouble of actually translating the index stuff into a number of units and using that for month-to-month comparison. Man, the price points were just all over the board this time. $9.99 was the most prolific price point, but only accounted for 12.33% of the items. The next one was $16.99, followed by $19.99. If we look at the $20 and below, or the $19.99 and below, that's two-thirds of the items on the list right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, we had stuff at the $100, $125, $150, and $200 price points. If we expand to looking at the top 500, we of course get a couple of more price points tossed in there just to, you know, add to the mix. But really, it is 69%, just a hair under. It's actually 68.99% of the items were $20 or below.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're still trying to keep things affordable, which I think is a good move. Having some of those higher priced items out there, it's always nice to get that coffee table edition or something like that if you can actually, you know, lift it, much less, you know, get it on your lap without crushing yourself and read it. but those are nice items to have, and they seem to be doing a decent job pacing the release of those and not, you know, flooding with them.
Yeah, I think they learned over time that you just can't have that many of those coming out. Otherwise, you kind of cannibalize your sales because people have to make decisions. Just like you said, sometimes when you were buying more stuff, your list would hit a certain level, and then you'd have to consider taking off maybe one of the, if you got a toy or if you got something, you know, a big ticket item, you'd have to consider whether you really wanted to push that limit, you know.
Yeah, anytime you look at your order and you realize, wow, that's a lot, the first thing you're going to do is look for the highest priced item of, do I need this?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can get rid of one item and keep all the rest, geez, it's so easy.
Yeah, right?
But it's, again, coming out with so much stuff that it raises that question that doesn't benefit the publisher at all.
Mm-hmm.
They should be coming out with so much that you can afford to get it all and you want to get it all. But that's kind of not always what happens.
Absolutely.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the monthly question. The Diamond Order Index only goes two decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.